This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.
Interviewing people like you has really provided me the wisdom that, all right, just take it one day at a time.
Yeah, I think that you need those disappointments. I think you because then when you finally get, like, when I got Jimmy Kimmel and I was like, in my head, I was like, until it actually showed up on TV, I was like, this is not going to show up.
Yeah, it's not going to happen.
They're going to cut me last minute. And then even I was like the last 5 minutes of the show. So up until, I mean, they kept saying my name. So I was like, it's going to happen. But I could just see them going, you know what? We ran out of time. So I think you need that because you get to a point where you're not jaded, but you're almost like, all right, I feel like you just start making your own path. Mm-hmm. You know, you try to get your own following, try to do your own things. And then anything that you get like that is just a bonus.
Hot Breath. What's up, Hot Breath-iverse? Welcome back. This is your favorite host, Joel Byers. And you know what time it is. Say it with me now. Hot Breath. Oh, Hot Breath episode 130 is in full swing. This is your favorite weekly podcast exploring everything comedy. Thank you for hanging out with me for this Hot Breath episode. This is with one of my favorite comedians ever right now. He is a genuine dude and an authentically funny comedian. You're going to enjoy hearing his story. I've got to say, you got to see this one on YouTube or on our social media at Hot Breath Pod. Because we talk a lot about his physicality and his gestures, and it just cracks me up even just see him do them on the podcast. We met up on the stairs of his Airbnb, so it's also a funny environment to watch a podcast. But he was in here in Atlanta for the Laughing Skull Fest, so I had to scoop up a little bit of his time and explore his story. So you're in for a treat with this one. A lot of good comedy insights and a lot of good just life stories. So thank you for your time. I'm so excited to share Hot Breath episode 130 with you, all my hot brethren and sistren. If you did just now start listening to Hot Breath, there's over 129 others for you to go back and explore now. So with that being said, I bid you adieu. And there is only one thing left to do. And that is inhale a hot breath. With Dusty Slay.
Save the goodies, you know? Yeah. Look at us in the stairwell. This is going to be classic, dude.
Yeah, this is great.
This is going to be classic.
Yeah, our only other option was to sit on the bed together, which I think that makes that's a different podcast.
That is a totally erotic pod.
Yeah.
Erotic pod. I don't know if that's a weird niche. You sit down, I'll just make sure this is in focus.
Great.
And we're gonna be good. We just wanna make sure we get your hat in focus. The Dusty Slay hat.
Yeah. This is a real fancy microphone.
Ooh, thanks, man.
It is. I know because my podcast microphones are not this heavy. This is so substantial.
What do you use?
I don't know. I went on this B&H Audio.
And they had
like the podcast setup.
Okay.
So I just bought that.
Oh, it all was included.
Yeah, they had a two mic thing. It's not this, which is
which
Zoom.
Recorder? Yeah, I use this
it's
one.
It's more like
H4.
It's more like a soundboard, like a mini soundboard.
Like a mixer kind of?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So
you
I
go
don't
directly
know.
Into the computer with it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know much about it. We actually, me and Hannah's last podcast, we recorded three times. The first time... we got into an argument and,
and you didn't keep it.
No, we were like, nah,
I can't.
And then the second, cause we got off on some tangents and I was like, and then, I was like, it got into politics and then I was agreeing with this one thing she was saying. And then she went back and corrected herself on something she said. And then I was like, oh no, now you've made me look terrible. and then she got mad at me and I was like, all right. And then we recorded the second time and our microphone was not working. So
sounds like a great marriage podcast.
Yeah. So by the third one, we were like, let's just do it.
Yeah.
She was not very happy, but it was a good time. It's a good time.
I could even tell in listening to the first one, you made you made a joke about, which first off, the podcast called We're Having a Good Time.
Yeah.
So just for people to go listen to that. But you made a joke about keeping your set tight, and then she made a joke about her being tight, and you just completely like did not even address
right.
it.
Yeah,
she like started laughing at how she likes making you uncomfortable.
Oh yeah, she loves to take it to a dirty place real fast.
Well, she's a comedian also.
Yes, yes.
So it's kind of like, you know.
And she knows that that makes me uncomfortable, so she loves to do it.
Is that why you get along, I guess? Just because you're like, yin and yang?
Yeah, it's a good balance.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you guys meet at a festival? How did that
Actually, we met at a new, open mic in New York City.
Whoa.
She was living in Canada. I was living in Charleston. And yeah, we met. And we didn't start dating there, but we stayed in touch.
Wow. If you're both, was it like one of those mics you like are in the basement and it's 20 comics and no one else and they all leave?
Yeah. And I don't drink. I quit drinking. And
like 29, right?
Yeah.
You spent a couple years. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, 6 years. And she had stopped drinking. She doesn't drink much, but she wasn't drinking at all then. So we just kind of found each other that way.
Oh, nice.
And I think she had said she was mad that day. And she was like, you know, she was like in this mode where she was just going to be hard. And then she found me and asked me a question. And I think my Southern accent really threw her off. And she didn't know what to do. Because I was just so nice. I was like, hey, how you doing?
Yeah, like as you do at the Dusty Sleigh way.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And she's from Canada hearing a Southern accent. That could be like you know, like an alien almost.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, because I like to really play the Southerner role in New York. I think that's why.
I bet you can really lean into
it. Unless I get lost, and then I like to pretend like I'm a New Yorker.
You have like a white voice you can go into.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because I do that. I'll call it my honky bonics.
Yeah.
If I get down in there, I can go there.
Oh,
you know, but I'm I've gotten braces. I'm, you know, private school, I'm very affluent now.
Yeah.
But we can go there.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. Like when you talk to the cops, you got to clean it up.
Right. Exactly.
You're like, yes, sir. I know I was speeding and I'm sorry.
That's what I love about your comedy is because like it's so authentic. And I remember the first time I saw you was at Punchline here in Atlanta.
Oh, yeah.
You were featuring. I don't remember who the headliner was. I just remember you featuring and was like, who is this incredibly funny comedian at moving at his own pace in his own authentic way?
Yeah. Well,
it's
I appreciate
impressive,
that. Yeah.
Man.
Well, that's, you know, actually that's what I've decided to do at this festival. And it's been the most successful for me because
at the Laughing Skull, yeah, or now.
When we get, when we get, you know, I do 30-minute sets all the time, 45-minute sets, and then I get a 5-minute set and I'm like, oh, I'm gonna cram 8 minutes.
Right.
And then I'm like, and then I lose that slow style. So I'm like, you know what, I'm gonna do 3 minutes in 5 minutes. You know, I'm just going to slow it down. I'm going to wave a lot. We're going to have a good time.
You're having a good time.
Yeah.
I love when you said that on your Kimmel set. You're like, oh, all right. You got like an applause break. You're like, oh, we're having a good time. Was that built into the set or did you just react that way?
Well, I have this joke where, and I said it on there where I'll say, no trash in this ditch unless it's white trash.
Right.
And sometimes that gets me a weird reaction from people. So I like to remind them, hey, we're just having a good time here. Don't freak out. It's fine.
Yeah, it works, dude.
Yeah.
And that's how you got Kimmel, was from being at a festival, right?
Yeah, I did Bridgetown in Portland, which I think they're not doing anymore. So I got in on the last one.
Yeah.
And yeah, the bookers from there sent my video to JFL. So I did a JFL audition.
Just for laughs?
Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't get that, but the booker for Kimmel was at the JFL audition, so...
And then how does that interaction even go down? Like what?
It was very casual, actually. Yeah. She was very nice, and she said,
"What's her name? What's her email? Do you have her number?"
Yeah. Well, it's Hannah Crichton is her name, and she's great.
Yeah.
And she's like, "You ever done late night?" And I was like, "No." She's like, "You want to do Kimmel?" And I was like, "Yeah." She's like, "All right, email me." And it was very casual. Mm-hmm. But then you know there was a process where you have to send in a video, and then. You have to send in like an 8-minute video and then they go, okay, we like that. Now narrow it down to 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and me, I'm always recording and you never can understand what I'm saying on my videotapes, you know? So I'm like, it took me forever. It should have took me 2 months. I think it took me 6 months.
How many submissions did you?
I only did 2.
Okay.
And they liked them both, but I was like, I would always go, no, I don't want to send this video. Either you couldn't, it wasn't clear or the audience didn't sound good. And I didn't want to send them some video of me getting a mediocre response and then them go, you know what, we're okay.
So you took in 6 months, it took you to record two sets to submit to them.
Yeah, and that's performing probably five shows every weekend.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just like, I don't know. I kept looking at them each weekend, just being like, nah, I don't want to send this.
Yeah, you know? You a bit of a perfectionist that way, or is it?
I think, yeah. I mean, when I'm sending something that I expect people to like and book me for, I want it to be just right. I don't want to give them any reason to go, we don't like this guy.
Even if it's like, the jokes may be good, but even if the video quality is bad, that could be a deterrent, even for bookers.
Right, I feel like if I'm booking a thing and I'm asking someone to send me a video and they send in some blurry video from a cell phone, I'm going, you don't care about this.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, that does make a difference.
So I want it to be good. But I feel like every time I get a good camera angle and I crush it, I go back and watch and it's like you can't, I don't know, my voice is off. Like, you can't understand anything I say. I sent in videos to America's Got Talent one time, and all the producers, I think, are British, and they were like, we can't understand what you're saying. Can you get a better recording? So I was like, I don't know what to do.
Is that the same thing that happened with Last Comic Standing? You had a little bit of a run on there that didn't kind of blow up.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what happened. My theory is that Last Comic Standing, they're always looking for the story, right?
So in my
auditions, I was doing trailer park jokes because I could use those jokes again throughout the audition process. But when I got to Last Comic Standing, I had 3 minutes, and they were like, you can't use these again. Once you use them, you can't use them again. So I was like, I only had a few trailer park jokes. So I was like, if I take 3 minutes out of this, it's going to kill my whole thing. So I went with some fish jokes, and they got great laughs, but I don't think that's what they were looking for. They're like, we don't need the fish joke comic.
They're like, oh, we'll just show pictures of him on the screen. as opposed to
we'll show him looking real nervous in the green room.
Yeah, it's your story is very similar to a lot of comedians I've heard, where they're like, this is it. This is my big break. I'm going to post this and let the whole world know my TV debut. And then you did that, right? And it,
well, they ask us to make a post.
Oh,
so I made one post, and it got a little bit of attention. It was good, but I made it like a week early. And then the day that Last Comic Standing was going to air, someone that I went to high school with shared it. And it was like a heartfelt post. Like, it was so nice, but it was like, my friend that I grew up with is now going to be on national TV. And so it got tons of likes. I mean, it blew up. And then I watched for 2 hours and never saw myself. And then I watched the whole season, just hoping that at some point I would pop up. But
yeah. Maybe I'm in the finals. You're like, maybe I won.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Who knows? Who knows? Maybe they'll go back and go, hey, let's show some other comics. Yeah. You know? But they never did.
Then they just show like a picture of you or something.
Yeah, I got two pictures in the green room, just hanging out, just having a good time. They were like, that's what this guy does. Just have a good time.
Those are the stories that, like, I filmed Comedy Central's Roast Battle.
Okay.
And they came to Atlanta and filmed it. And I was like, okay, I've interviewed enough people to know this may not happen. So I didn't say anything. Like, I didn't post about it. It was going to premiere in Atlanta because they didn't tell me I wasn't going to air. But when it aired, I wasn't even on it. And I was like, oh my gosh. One, thank goodness that wasn't my TV debut. Like, it went well and I won the round. But it's like, in hindsight, that's not really what I want to be the first thing.
Right.
And second is that it just didn't air. So if I was like, hey, I'm on Comedy Central, check me out.
Yeah,
and then it airs and they're like, oh, really, Joel?
Oh,
that's what you're doing with your life? So interviewing people like you has really provided me the wisdom that, all right, just take it one day at a time.
Yeah, I think that you need those disappointments. I think because then when you finally get, like, when I got Jimmy Kimmel and I was like, in my head, I was like, until it actually showed up on TV, I was like, this is not going to show up.
Yeah, this is not going to happen. Yeah.
They're going to cut me last minute. And then even I was like the last 5 minutes of the show. So up until, I mean, they kept saying my name. So I was like, it's going to happen. But I could just see them going, you know what? We ran out of time.
bump Dusty.
Yeah. But so I think you need that because you get to a point where you're not jaded, but you're almost like, all right, I feel like that you just start making your own path. You know, you try to get your own following, try to do your own things. And then anything that you get like that is just a bonus.
Yeah, that's another thing that you've inspired me with is I'm still based out of Atlanta.
Yeah.
Because one, I just love the scene here. I feel like the scene it's is great. Boiling right now.
It is.
And there's a lot of people even that you're seeing on TV, whether it be like performing a stand-up set or acting or writing, that started in Atlanta that have then moved on or that still live here.
Yeah.
So I'm like, why move and start over when you just, you could get it done here? Like, you're based out of Nashville, but you were still able to get on TV.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, everybody always says that my next step is to move to New York or LA, but I don't know. I mean, I like living in Nashville. I like my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I feel like that I'm getting better at comedy all the time. Just as long as you're writing and performing all the time,
mm-hmm.
just going to get better. I mean, I have no doubt that if I moved to New York and was doing six sets a night, that I could really, really work it, you know? But I don't know. Right now, I'm pretty happy. But you're right, though. Atlanta's hot, and that's what a guy, David Perdue, was saying to me last night.
Yeah, he's been on here, yeah.
That he was like, I like living... He said the same thing. He's like, I like that you made it on Kimmel while still living in Nashville.
Yes.
And I like that, too. I mean, I think it's fun. I like to go on stage and be introduced as from Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm introduced as Dusty Slay from New York City and I'm like, I come out and I talk like this, it's like, that's not going to make sense.
Yeah.
You know?
Like, he's an infiltrator.
Yeah.
How effective have you seen, because you did get Kimmel from going to Bridgetown, which is in Portland, way far from Nashville. Have you done a lot of festivals and have you seen them worth it? Like the investment, time, travel, submission?
I don't do a lot. I just think it's important to do a good festival.
Okay.
But I think that I mean, that's hard to figure out, but you just ask around, you know, be like, what's a good one? But I think if you've never done a festival, these lower level festivals are great because you get into one and then when you apply for the bigger one, you can at least say, I've been to this festival, and at least you're doing something. But once you get into the bigger festivals, I don't see any reason to do the smaller ones,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm not trashing them, but I just, sometimes you show up to a festival and, you know, there's like no one in the audience and you're like, oh, this is like a showcase in my own hometown.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I could do this anywhere, but it's like Atlanta, this festival's great. Bridgetown was great. I mean, you get a lot of audiences, a lot of people that don't normally see me.
And I've found festivals, the few I've done, the biggest piece may not be the shows as much as just the people you meet.
Yeah.
Is that what you find similar?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little different for me in Portland than Atlanta, because Atlanta, you know, I'm familiar with. I get to come here a pretty good bit. Mm-hmm. Portland, I'd never been to. So it was fun to do these Alabama trailer park jokes in Portland. You know, and because it's fun for me, because I'm not going to Portland and then trashing everyone that I grew up with. I'm just observing, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, so I'm not like, look at these hillbillies. I'm like, look at me. I'm one of those hillbillies. You know what I mean? And that's what's fun to me.
Yeah.
I like to, you know, I think making fun of myself is fun. Sometimes I love to do that on social media. I love to bash my gigs and bash my hotels. Not bash them, but be like, look at this ridiculous thing I'm doing. People tell me that I shouldn't do that because then it looks like I don't get good gigs. But I do get good gigs, but I'm also doing some bad gigs.
It's authentic.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's what people gravitate towards.
Yeah.
Authenticity.
Like, I did this.
Authenticity.
I did a show in Tennessee recently, uh-huh. and on the marquee was just, it said, now hiring servers and cooks, comedy Saturday night. And I was there on Friday and Saturday. So they didn't even advertise a Friday show. And then they were like, no one's here. You know, we had a few people, but it was still fun. But it's like, it's fun to make fun of that.
Yeah, you just got to roll with the punches, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, one minute I was like at Hilarities in Cleveland. I headlined tonight and then I featured for a great comic and it was fun. It was, everything was, mm-hmm. you know, fancy. The hotel was great. And then the next week, you know, they don't even advertise my name.
I interviewed Sam Morrell on here, and he was talking about one night opening up for Amy Schumer in front of like 10,000 people. The very next night, open mic, 10 people.
Right, right.
Just that juxtaposition.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what's so fun about it. Like, comedy really has a way to keep you humble.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam Morrell, I worked with him at the Laughing Skull here. I really liked him, and I think, I mean, he has he's a great joke writer.
Yes.
You know, and that's what's fun to me. I like people that write jokes.
Yeah, that's what I really enjoyed about him. And also just, people don't understand the specificity of joke writing. And when I asked Sam about one of his Conan sets, and just like the joke writing. And I was like, you did this gesture here. Was that all choreographed? He's like, I was just reacting. He like made it no. And I was like, oh, like it's fun to see how fine tuned some things are. So like even in your Kimmel set, how fine tuned were mannerisms and pauses? Like how dialed in was that set?
Well, that set's pretty dialed in.
Right.
I'm like, I know what I want to do. But yeah, when I'm just doing a longer set, I mean, I'm waving just at everything. Like it's a good way. Like if someone heckles you, I can give them a little wave like that. Like, you know, or if people have weird laughs sometimes. So instead of having to address it, I just give them a wave and the audience gets it. They're like, we heard that too.
I get it.
Yeah.
I don't know why it just, I think that's something that when the first time I saw you perform, like that subtlety, it just hits. I don't know why, but.
Sometimes it's like if someone's heckling you, sometimes it can be like a Jedi mind trick. You know, like, all right.
And it just quells the
situation. Yeah, a lot of times, not always, but a lot of times you get people that are too drunk to get anything. You know, they don't get if you're, and some people just want to be made fun of.
Mm-hmm.
Like after the show, you didn't make fun of them. They're disappointed. I had a guy go, I was like, hey, I like that shirt. And he's like, yeah, I wore this so you'd make fun of me. And I was like, oh, if I'd have seen you, I would have did it. And I was just humoring him. And then he goes, what would you have said? I was like, all right, well, I'm not just going to roast you right here.
On demand.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't, and that's why, you know, like people, one guy was dressed like the Day Man or maybe Always Sunny, like Charlie Day did the, I don't know what, Day Man or Night Man.
He had like the body suit thing.
Well, he had like a full green suit or something.
Right,
he was right up front. And it's like, I feel like that guy, he wore that to be made fun of.
Yeah. Everybody noticed. You dressed the obvious.
Right.
How do you normally deal with hecklers? What have you found to be the most efficient way?
Well, I think for me, just being nice is the best way, because if I get like any kind of like aggressive, like I feel like the audience gets weird because I've just been nice and fun the whole time. And if all of a sudden I'm like, shut up, people are like, oh, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
But it's hecklers don't really bother me so much. It's just like I had a guy in the front row at a show and he was really drunk and he was just almost just making comments to me that no one else could hear.
Yep, I've been there.
I was like, can you guys kick this guy out of here? And they didn't. He was very muscular. But I tried to make fun of him a little bit and then just be like, and we worked through it. Yeah, but some of those, it's like, there's nothing you can do. It's like, I just like that guy to be quiet and just leave. But it's like, he's the kind of guy that like, even in a setup, he's commenting on your setups. And he came up to me after the show. He was trying to hug me. He was like, I was like, dude, like, I don't know. He was like, but that helped a little. I was like, I just want you to know. I told him, I said, I just want you to know you didn't help this show. I don't want you to leave here thinking that you helped, thinking that you were part of the show. You weren't. I didn't enjoy it. And he didn't get it. And as he was leaving, he was asking the feature. He was like, I helped, right?
And it was like, I just don't even know.
Yeah, it's like, dude.
And that's the thing with a lot of hecklers is they almost feel like they are helping. They're
not
always, most really aren't even ill-intentioned. They really just think they're helping.
Yeah.
So it is, I guess, being that nice piece is crucial to not lose the audience.
Yeah.
They all think they don't all think he's helping, but.
Yeah. They're like, what's wrong with this guy up there? Why do you get so mad?
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, when you're in a zone and the audience is listening, you can really just tell your jokes and it's a great time for everyone. But one person can ruin that whole mood.
Yeah.
So that's why being nice and just being like, hey, I appreciate you being here.
Will you go back and forth with them, or you're like, thanks for being here, and you kind of keep moving, and if they keep going, then you come back to it?
Yeah, I try to just move on.
Yeah, move on.
But, you know, sometimes like just repeating what someone says can be funny. Like if they say some weird thing, you just repeat it into the microphone, then the audience laughs, and then it can be fun. But then it's almost like in their minds, they're like, oh, I gave him that joke.
Yeah.
I'm going to give him another one.
Yep.
I'm going to keep this going.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, my goal is to just be the kind of comic that no one wants to heckle.
You're just too nice of a guy. They don't want to disturb you.
Yeah, and I'm not touching on any subject that could really be sensitive to them. But, you know, I did a show in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan, and I think they have like a, you know, a Native American population. So I have a joke about baskets, just a general basket joke. And then this lady goes, baskets are sacred to us.
Oh.
And I was like, all right. All right. If I can't make fun of baskets, this is too far.
That was a helpful hint, though, I
yeah,
guess.
Yeah,
yeah. Hey, tread. It's like it's like religion joke. Yeah. Like, all right, move on from that
yeah.
one.
Yeah, I was like, wow, I had no idea. Making fun of a sweetgrass basket was so intense.
Have you ever been booed on stage?
Never booed.
Oh,
never booed. Knock on wood. Yeah.
What is like your most epic bomb failure experience?
Well, I've opened for Ari Spears several times.
I have too, because he only books white openers.
Right.
That was a big controversy after our interview.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he, the first time we worked together, there was a regular show, host, feature, Aries. It's great. I loved it. Second time I get there, it's two man show, just me and Aries. Oh. And I'm better at that now, but for a long time, me hitting the stage first is not the way to go. And we need somebody, even someone just to come up and give announcements. Mm.
Instead of just, all right.
Yeah.
Ari Spears will be here soon, guys.
Right.
Yeah.
But the whole weekend was good. But the late show Friday, I was on stage and the audience was just quiet. I'd hit joke after joke and they were just not into it. And then like some guy made a weird noise in the audience. And I was like, oh, someone's dying out there. And he goes, no, you're dying. I was like, I just shrank down. Because he was so right. I was like, I don't even know what to say to that.
How far into the set was that?
I think I had about 10 minutes to go.
Oh.
So it wasn't too early. But I think I left the stage a bit early. I never do that. Mm-hmm. I always do time. But I was like, you know what? Aries is going to do 90 minutes anyway. I'm just going to get out of here.
What was the makeup of the audience?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, but, you know, Aries is not total like an urban comic, you know. But, I think he had a lot of free tickets on that late show. And I think free ticket people just tend to be not invested in the show.
Yeah,
they're like, we don't care about this. We got free tickets. We're paying $30 for drinks. We don't care.
Yeah. I've been there, man. I've definitely been there where you're just, it's even like 5 minutes in and it's not going well. And you're like, I still have 20 more minutes to figure something out here.
Yeah, that's why if that's happening to me after a few jokes, I like to say, I'll go, that's a good joke. That's a good joke, guys. You can laugh at these. You know, feel free to get in here. Laugh at these jokes. Let's have a good time, you know?
Yeah.
That's where that we're having a good time. I mean, me and my wife actually started saying that to each other. You know, we'd just be like, we're having a good time. But I started saying that on stage for the shows when it didn't seem like people were having a good time. I would just go, hey, we're having a good time. I don't like to ask. I like to tell. We're having a good time.
Do you find that almost coerces them into, oh, I guess we are having a good time?
Yeah, I mean, my thought is that a lot of times if you're not doing well, the audience either feels bad for you or they feel like this is what you do all the time. They're like, oh, this guy must bomb all the time. So I like to let them know, this is not how my shows normally go.
Mm-hmm.
You can laugh at these jokes. Get in here. And then I feel like that they see a real side to you. They're like, all right, this is a real person up here.
Yeah.
He's self-aware. He notices that we're not into it. And he seems to be okay with it.
I can imagine, especially you transitioning from feature to headliner. Like feature set, you're in the honey spot. You're couched in, they're ready to rock. You only have to do 20 to 30 minutes. You can just rock it out. But
yeah,
that next level, dude.
Yeah, it's definitely a change.
Yeah.
Especially if the feature, I mean, I'm pretty low energy. I'm fairly clean. So it's like if the feature is real high energy and real dirty and they do well, it can be a bit hard to follow. It can be, you know, just a real moment of transition. But I don't know. I mean, I guess you just work through it, you know. But I mean, I've had some, none of my headlining sets have been bad, but I've had some that are, you know, pretty mediocre where one night I was doing my CD pitch at the end and I was like, hey, you know, if you want to hear what it's like when people laugh at these jokes, I got a couple of CDs for you. I was like, you guys don't think I travel the country doing mediocre sets like this, do you?
Did anybody buy any?
I don't think I sold any that night, but I got a great laugh off that joke.
Yeah.
But that's why I think it's important just to find your audience, because there are people that love my jokes. So I just, wherever I go, I just try to, you know, try to make an effort to get people's emails, to try to get them to say, hey, you know, come back to this show next time I'm here. Mm-hmm. If you like what I'm doing, I'll be doing this kind of thing next time.
What are some other tactics you use to generate a Dusty Slave following?
Well, I use, and I don't know the total effectiveness of any of these things, but I use the Facebook fan page, because you can sponsor an ad, you can put some money behind it and target it to a town and specific demographics. And you can see, like, I can tell that the people that watch my videos are from 25 to 45 and mostly men. Apparently women aren't that into my stuff. And
it's okay. Have a good time.
Yeah. And it's always weird to see that, though, when I pull up and it's like 80% of the listens are from men. And, you know, so I'm like, oh, okay. So,
but it's accepting, knowing your audience and just doubling down on that. Totally. Right?
And then it's like, so you can target it to people when you go into those towns, and then it shows up on their Facebook feed. And then I like to collect emails and just email. I don't send out a monthly newsletter. Maybe I should, but I just like to say, hey, I'm coming back in a week. Get some tickets. Come see me.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm headlining, it really works. It's different when I'm featuring, because I feel like they also have to really like the headliner, you know?
To translate to you?
Right. If I'm like, hey, I'll be in Tampa and I'll be with this guy. If they don't like that guy, they're like, I don't know. It's not worth it.
And to gather emails, do you have like a clipboard that you have emails, or do you type it in your phone?
I just do a notepad. I do a notepad, and then I go home and struggle to figure out people's drunk handwriting.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You make them write it down. And
yeah. 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 And they, yeah. And it's like, I'm always amazed at people's handwriting. I'm like, wow, this makes no sense.
Oh, I host a weekly show here in Decatur, Georgia on Wednesdays, and I'll just collect emails through people writing, and half of them I can't even input.
Oh, yeah.
It's like people don't know how to write anymore.
So. Right, yeah. But I thought about, you know, getting like the keyboard thing on an iPad, but then mm-hmm. I thought, well, you know, they're drunk and they're typing. It's going to be clearer to read that they typed their email wrong.
Right.
You know.
Or they just steal it. That was right. Because I want to just pass around an iPad. My wife is like, what's going to prevent people from just stealing that?
Yeah.
That's why I have a wife, to talk me off the ledge of being too philanthropic.
Yeah. Yeah. And then they got all your emails too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, I had the square where I would use for merch, and I have an outer box, whatever it's called on the phone, and the thing wouldn't fit. So I would have to take the case off. And then I was always so afraid. I was like, I'll hold it. You just sign it. And then I felt like that I had to explain to everyone that this phone costs a lot of money and they don't give these away anymore. They don't let us sign a contract and get a free phone. So I'm like, I can't break this.
Yeah.
You have to let me hold it.
Selling merch is something I've just started to tip my toe in the water on. And it can be difficult. I may do a show in front of 300 people and maybe not sell anything. I may do a show in front of 30 people and sell 10 things. Yeah. What have you found to be the best way of selling merch?
Well, I feel like you gotta have a good sales pitch. Like, I try to keep my merch pitch funny. Sometimes I'll get applause breaks on my merch pitch because, you know, I don't know. I just work on making it funny. I don't want that to be a dip in the show. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be like, we're not doing comedy anymore. Now I'm selling you things. It's like, I'm selling you things and we're still doing jokes. But sometimes it can just be, you know, really humbling to stand at your merch table while people pass by and make no eye contact with you. I want to be like, hey, I'm not a homeless man. I'm not broke. I'm just if you want it, buy it. If not, you don't have to look at me. You don't have to go like this. But I think that sometimes when I do the worst, I sell the most stuff. Hmm. I had a show not too long ago where I was tempted. I didn't feel that great about it. I was tempted to not even go set up. And then I sold a ton of stuff.
Hmm.
It was very strange.
Yeah.
But it's like, sometimes I think that we think as comedians that we're not doing well, but the audience has a great time. I know I watch comedy shows all the time, and sometimes I never laugh and I enjoy the whole thing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, we think that, you know, on stage we're like, I gotta have laughs every 30 seconds. I need a laugh. And it's like, sometimes people are just enjoying listening to you.
Yeah.
You know?
I have found some of the people I see in the audience not laughing, those are the ones that come up to you after and are like, you just made my week or month. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I've had guys that they sit there with their arms crossed and look mad the whole time. And after the show, they're like, hey, great set, man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, well, you could have cracked a smile. I focused on you the whole time.
You ruined my show.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah. Glad you had fun.
What are some of your merch pitches? Can you give us an example of how you make it funny?
Well, I like to say, I'll pitch my CD and then I'll say, I'll be out there after the show. I'll be out there selling these, or at the very least, I'll be out there holding them. And that actually got me an applause break. It doesn't seem funny at all right here, but it got me an applause break in a club in Lexington. Uh-huh. I said, well, I'll be out there holding them. And I was like, I don't know how to react to this applause break. I feel like you guys are like, this guy is very self-aware.
Mm, yeah.
And and then I used to say, I would pitch the CD and I would say, let's say you'd like to buy this, but you're not interested in listening to it. That's okay. In fact, you can buy this for me and then just go out in the parking lot and just throw it down on the ground. I'll just pick it up, try to sell it in the next show.
Nice.
And it's just like, I'm just trying to let them know without saying it that I'm like, I don't care if you buy it. I only want you to buy it if you really want to. Like, so I've had people just come up and give me money before. They're like, I don't want to buy anything, but here's some money. And I'll take that too. But I would rather people buy things because they really like the show.
It seems you've touched on self-awareness a couple times in this. Have you found that the more self-aware you become, almost the more successful the better your comedy gets?
I mean, who knows? But I think that it's important to know when you're not doing well. And to also know when you are doing well. Like, I know comics that every time they have a set, it'll be a good set, and they come off and they're like, oh, I hated that. I hated this audience. My jokes are no good. And it's like, you got to take it easy on yourself. But I also know comics that will bomb the entire time and then come off like, yes, you know? And I'm like, you got to know when you're doing well and know when you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And you get, I don't know. And it's like, maybe there's no way to ever fully know, but yeah, it's important to be like, all right, this joke's, because I'll write a new joke and I'll try it out for a week. If it's not getting anything, I'm like, either I got to rewrite this or I got to stop telling it. You know, even if you really like the joke, if it's bombing every time, there's no need to tell that joke.
But I think self-awareness can play into your comedy writing as well, and what material, you being aware of how you look on stage, how you're being perceived, can drive your writing.
Yeah. I always just try to keep it light. Even like I'm just up here telling jokes. I'm not trying to change anyone's mind on anything, you know. But I also am not trying to say that that's what I'm doing. You know, I'm not up there on stage being like, I'm not going to talk about anything, because there are comics that talk about things and they do that well, and I want them to keep doing that. But that's not what I do. I'm going to do Trailer Park Jokes and talk about a TV that I dropped off at Goodwill. You know what I mean? That's my joke, because that's what I'm doing. I'm eating at the Cracker Barrel a lot. You know what I mean?
But that fits.
Yeah.
Like the self-awareness. That fits, like if you were to say the brand, I mean, that all fits into that filter.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's important to do that without, like, as a Southern comic, I feel like you can fall into the trap of, I don't want to say hacky, but you can get cheesy with it, maybe, and it's like, that's trying to do funny Trailer Park Jokes without being too cheesy. And even if you have a cheesy joke, I think it's fun to throw a nice twist at the end. Like, I had this joke where I say, when you hang out with a lot of broke people all the time, like I do, everything's always fancy to them. Like the other day I was hanging out with my mom, which I think is funny. Nobody ever gets that part. And we were out to dinner and she was like, this is so fancy. And I'm like, Mom, it's Olive Garden. Of course it's fancy.
You know, right.
Because when I say that, Mom, it's Olive Garden, I can feel the audience be like, oh, cheesy joke. And then when you go, of course it's fancy, it brings them all around.
Yeah.
But that's also a joke, depending on the town, people in the audience are like, I don't get that joke. The Olive Garden is fancy. Mm. You know what I mean? That's our restaurant. That's where I went for my anniversary,
right,
buddy? You take it easy on the Olive Garden. It's the only white tablecloths we have in town.
People of your own ilk,
yeah,
feel that way.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, my dad is not the guy for me to test out material on. Mm. You know what I mean? Like
preaching to the choir.
Yeah, he's like, I don't get that. You know, you know. I mean, I would, if I think my parents maybe even judge my comedy by the level of success that I have. If it were just based on my jokes, I think they would think that I was not successful.
Are they proud of you? Like
they are. They are. Yeah. But I just mean my jokes are not written for my parents. You know what I mean? I mean, not that anyone's probably writing jokes for their parents. I don't know any comics that are like, I'm writing this for my dad.
Yeah, it's like, well, make sure my dad's cool with this.
Right.
Are they cool? Like on Kimmel, you're making, you know, trailer park jokes. Are they like, hey, why would you joke about that? Or is it?
Oh, no. My parents are divorced. My dad never lived in a trailer park, so he doesn't care at all. And my mom thinks it's hilarious.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why I try to, like, my whole goal is to make fun of things about my life growing up without trashing the way I grew up, you know? Because for whatever reason, however I was raised the way I was raised, it is what it is. I think everybody did a great job. But there is still funny stuff that surrounds it, you know? If my parents could have been millionaires, I'm sure they would have loved that.
Did it start off as embarrassing? Like, did you almost have to warm up to even talk about those personal things?
I think, no, I mean, not... doing comedy really helped me, like, you know, growing up, I always had friends that weren't in trailer parks. I had a few friends that were, but I mean, most of my friends in high school and stuff, they didn't live in trailers, you know? So it was like, I was a little self-conscious about it all the time. So being able to talk about it on stage just wiped that all away. It became now like a source of pride almost. And it works like that for people after shows. People come up to me and they're like, hey, I grew up in a trailer park too. Which I feel like is the only time they were ever able to be proud of that.
Right.
You know? So that's what, you know, I'm just trying to say that world exists. Mm-hmm. And there's stuff in it that's funny. But we don't have to trash those people.
What has been the feedback after Kimmel and putting that on the national stage? What kind of people have been reaching out to you that way?
Well, you know, I don't know that late night is exactly what it used to be.
From an exposure standpoint. Yeah.
Because, you know, I mean, there's a lot of late night shows. There's Netflix. A lot of people aren't even watching TV now.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely helps me get respect amongst comics, respect amongst my family. And also, you know, it helps with bookings. I mean, if a ton of people have late night, but that many more plus don't have late night. So it helps you put you at a next level to where people take you more seriously. But it wasn't like, oh, this guy did Kimmel. He's headlining this club now. You know, it's not like that, but it definitely helps.
What did it sound like? It didn't really change anything.
Well, it's like almost. A lot of places that I featured at, I got bumped up to headliner because of that, because I have a credit. And then, yeah, it opened some doors to some things. And even being at this festival this year, I mean, I felt like that I was at a different, like, because most of the festivals I go to, people are from LA, Chicago, and New York.
Mm-hmm.
I'm usually the only Nashville comic at a festival. This year we had a couple of people here, which was great. But so it puts me at a different level now. Now people are like, oh, this guy lives in Nashville and he's been on Kimmel. Like, and it puts me almost at I don't know. I feel like it puts me in a different space. It gives me more confidence too, you know. It's done a lot, but not necessarily in the ways that you can see. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
And you mentioned before we got on air here that we're talking about being at the Laughing Skull Fest this year and the networking piece and how you've been able to get a lot of networking done. But there's a balance between, like, you want to meet people, but you don't want to be that guy who's
right.
Like, where's the industry? And you're like sniffing it out. How do you walk that line?
Well, that's tough for me. But I had my industry showcase that I had at where, you know, and that is, you know, the showcase where all the industry people are at.
Mm-hmm.
It went great. I had a great set and it was the right environment for me. I mean, it was the City Winery, which is almost like some of the big comedy clubs that I do. I was like, this is my audience. So I felt like it was going to go well. So I had this comfort level and I didn't do any jokes from my Kimmel set. That was my goal. Like, if the people saw me and then they were like, who's this guy? And then went and watched my Kimmel set, they would go, oh, he didn't do any of those jokes. That was my goal. I didn't want them to go see me, do well, and then go watch Kimmel and go, oh, that's all the jokes he has.
Mm-hmm.
So it went well. And then I just try to put myself in the position to be available for people to talk to me. You know, like at the after party, I'm not always surrounded by a crowd of people, you know? So I kind of hang, I'll talk to one or two people here and there, and it makes me available. And I'll be sneaky about it and position myself next to someone and go, you know, so they can hopefully go, hey, I really enjoyed your set. And then I can talk to them, you know, shake their hand. Or if I see them alone, I can go over and just say, hey. I just try to talk to people like regular people, even though they are these people of importance that, that I need things from. I also am like, you know what? I'm booked up for several months. If they don't talk to me, it's not the end of the world. I want them to, but I'm still going to do my gig in Arkansas next weekend. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, I think it's, you know, I've worked in the corporate world. Like I was a sales rep. I sold pesticides for a long time.
That's so perfect. Yeah, I can see a TV show of you doing that, man. Yeah. That's so perfect.
So, you know, I had to get used to talking to Lowe's managers and Home Depot managers. Yeah. And even though it doesn't seem the same, when you're in that world, I need things from those managers just like I need things from industry people now.
Mm-hmm.
I can still do my job without them, but they can make my job a lot easier.
How do the conversations go?
Well, I just try to talk. I bellhopped for a little while at this place, and they had the earpiece, and they would tell you the person's name, and you had to go out there and you go, "Oh, Mr. Jenkins, welcome back to the." And I'm not good at that. I'm not good at being a phony person.
Right.
So I just I feel like it's important for me to do well, and then to see me do well, and then our conversation is different. I'm not trying to prove myself to them in conversation, which is important.
Mm.
Because I always do this even at an open mic. If I go to a new town and I don't know anyone there, I don't really talk to people at the open mic until after the show's over. Because then they've seen me be funny and now we can talk on that level.
Yeah. You know?
There was this movie that I saw a long time ago. It was a movie called The Tao of Steve. And I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's T-A-O, The Tao of Steve. And he was just this kind of overweight guy. And he was talking about how he picked up women, right? And one of his rules was to let them see you be great at whatever you're great at. You know, so it's like, if you're great at horseshoes, you go to a party where there's horseshoes at and you make sure that girl sees you be good at that, you know? And then that just gives you an in. So I think that is how I approach comedy. It's like, comedy is what I'm good at. There's not a ton of things that I am good at, but comedy is. And so I let them see me be good at comedy, and then I talk to them.
That's a mistake I think a lot of younger comics make. Like, how long have you been doing comedy?
About 10 years.
About 10 years, yeah.
I mean, 5 years really working it. 5 years figuring it out.
Well, you started in like 2004 in overalls and no shoes, right? And then you quit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's not my mode.
Yeah, I did it. And I was doing improv, and I had a buddy that I was doing improv with. He was like, you should do comedy and do that country character. I'm like, oh, you mean be me?
Yeah.
And, but Larry the Cable Guy was really popular at the time. So we did the overalls. I was doing no shoes.
Oh my God.
And I was just like, I had no idea what I was doing. And the first couple of times I did it, it went great. So I was like, all right, I like this. And then I started bombing. And there's nothing like bombing and then still sitting there with your overalls on.
And you know? Shoes.
Yeah. You're like, you got this whole getup on and now you're bombing. So I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. So I just quit. And then actually that same guy in 2008 texted me and he was like, hey, I got this show. I need someone to do stand-up. Do you want to do it? And I was like, yeah, I'll do it. And then me and him wrote that letters of the alphabet joke that I have off my first CD, which if you haven't heard, it's really fun. And off Making That Fudge. And that's what the album's called.
It's a good time.
Yes, it is. And we wrote that, and I did that on stage, and it went great. And I was like, man, I love this. And so slowly from there, I started getting back into it. Mm. And it was 2012 when I quit drinking. So I did 4 years of doing open mics, half drunk, and then partying right after.
Right. Yep.
And then once I quit drinking, it really just, I don't know, my brain cleared up, and I just went to writing, and it was much better.
Did you have like a problem drinking? You have like a rock bottom or you?
Yeah, I don't know. I think beat up myself. Just, you know, it was more, I don't think it was so much like the drinking, like an alcoholism thing. It was more like once I start drinking, then I'm like, I just want to keep drinking. And then I want to smoke a pack of cigarettes. I want to eat a whole pizza. And just, I was getting fat. I couldn't breathe. And then I was just like, I looked bad. I was like, this is not working.
Right.
So I yeah. So once I quit drinking, I mean, my health improved. I started eating better because I wasn't, you know, I didn't need to, you know, you don't want to wake up hungover and eat a salad. You know what I mean? Yeah. No one's thinking of healthy choices mm-hmm. on a hungover day. So I would go to bed eating a pizza and wake up eating a Hardee's sausage biscuit. You know what I mean?
Gosh, dude. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I used to get the loaded omelet biscuit from Hardee's.
Oh,
I actually sometimes would get the loaded omelet biscuit and the biscuits and gravy. And after I ate the biscuits and gravy, I would put some gravy on the loaded omelet biscuit.
The double dip, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. And then I'm just eating that, wondering why I'm getting fat.
Right, you know? And can't breathe.
I'm like, what's happening?
Why am I bad at comedy?
Yeah.
I can't breathe.
I was, yeah, and the last day, the day I decided to quit drinking, I was trying to smoke a cigarette with my roommate, and I didn't even have, like, the lung capacity to pull the cigarette, and I was like, what am I doing?
Oh.
So I just threw it out, and then I just quit. Mm-hmm. I was like, that's it.
And your comedy took off from there.
Yeah, I mean, I had about a month where I was even deciding whether I wanted to keep doing comedy.
Wow.
Because quitting drinking, I was like, well, I'm going to be in the bars all the time. And I'm like, I was hosting a weekly open mic, so I was still doing that. And then I was like, I don't know. And then I was thinking about quitting, but I had already entered a contest in Charleston. So then I went and then I won that. And I was like, all right, I'm going to keep doing it. And then I won another contest shortly after that in Charleston. And I was like, all right, let's keep this going.
Yeah.
I just got, I was still doing well even when I was drinking. But it really tightened up. And I could just being at the party, I haven't seen anybody really make a fool of themselves, right? But I could see how I would make a fool of myself in these parties.
Mm-hmm. Get carried away.
Yeah. I mean, like, there was a guy, he was carrying around a bottle of Fireball, and he offered it to me. And I was like, oh, no. But, you know, 6 years ago, I would have been like, let's do this.
Secondhand Fireball.
Yeah, me and you, we're drinking this.
Ugh. That's saying when you get that early success, like a contest as a comedian, you almost feel entitled to, like, well, where's my TV special? Why am I not dubba dubba dubba?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the disappointment racks up in comedy. I mean, you got to deal with disappointment or it's never going to work. Very few people get noticed right away. And even getting noticed only means, you know, some next level of success. I mean, people will be like, oh, that guy just, where'd that guy come from? You know, like somebody like Bert Kreischer, for instance, I feel like, I just work with him. I feel like he's 45 and I think he's been doing comedy for 20 years.
Yes.
Most people just found out about him in the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, they're like, feel like it's an overnight success. And it's like, no, this guy's been working it for years. And now he's got his deserved break. And he's great. His shows crush. He was not feeling well the weekend we worked together, and he was still crushing it every show. Like, he would be like, we went to lunch, and he almost couldn't talk. He had lost his voice. But by the time he got to showtime, he's ready to go. And it's like, because he's a professional. He's done it for 20 years.
Exactly.
Some of these YouTube stars, and I'm not trashing them. Good for them. But they barely done comedy, and they got this huge amount of success, and then their shows aren't good because they haven't put in the work.
Got to put in the work.
Yeah, and I don't know. Oh yeah, the first contest I won in Charleston. I mean, this is sarcasm, but I thought there was going to be a parade. You know what I mean? I thought I've won the competition, and it was a
Super Bowl.
It was immediate letdown. I had this girl that I was going to go on a date with. She stood me up the next day. So it was like immediate letdown.
Yeah.
And so you learn to deal with that in comedy. If you don't, my improv teacher told me a long time ago, he said, if you can't handle a bad set, then you might as well quit now because you're going to have a lot more of them. You know?
Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, the moment that I think that I can never have a bad set again, I have three of them. You know.
Oh, and it's always, that's why I get worried when things are going well. Cause I'm like, oh, something bad is brewing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And another Nashville comic at the festival, Aaron Weber, he said to me, which is the exact thought I've had a lot of times. He said, he had a set the other night that went great. He was like, this set went so well, I thought they were laughing at me. He's like, I thought my fly was down or something. And I've had those moments where you're like, this shouldn't be this funny. I don't understand what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
This joke is on me. There's a picture of me as a baby behind me. It's got to be.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah.
But
how do you, like you said with Bert Kreischer, he was sick, but he was able to overcome that adversity and perform. Do you have any specific habits or anything that help you to, even when you're not feeling it, to still take it to the performance level, even when you don't want to?
I think there's something that just happens when you get on stage. You just, like, even if you don't feel well, you get up there and it just kind of all goes away. Now, I haven't had any challenge of like trying to do it with the flu, but I was doing a bar show in DC, and it was raining, it was cold. I had lost my voice and my shoes got soaked. So I was at the thing and I was sick, I was cold. And so I took my shoes off because they were soaked, and I did the whole show with barely a voice in my socks.
Wow.
And it went great. I mean, it didn't go as well as it would have gone had I not had those things. But the fact that I was still able to do like 40 minutes with no shoes and no voice, I was pretty proud of that. But it's just like, yeah, you get the energy, you get the rush. You're like, this is great. I'm doing comedy. I'm not selling pesticides anymore.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, all these bookings you're getting, is this through a manager, or are you doing this through word of mouth?
Yeah, I have a manager, and I also have someone that's kind of an agent for me. Uh-huh. She's really helped me a ton. I say she's kind of an agent for me because she's not an agent. She works at a comedy club, but she's really helped me a ton. Just her being able to reach out. But yeah, a lot of it's my own stuff too. It's just I email, I'll send a short video. What I always like to do is I like to send one like 2-minute video and then one like video length of whatever I'm trying to do at the club. Like if I'm trying to feature, I'll send them a 30-minute video. But I'm like, I just figured the chances are they're not going to want to watch a 30-minute video, but they will watch a 2-minute video. So I give them the 2-minute. If they like it, then I'm saying, here's proof that I can do the time that I'm saying I can do.
How do you word those emails?
I'm just always nice. I feel like that I have my own little 3 P's of email. I say it's patience, persistence, and being polite. Because it's so easy to feel rejected. Like if a booker doesn't email you back or emails you back without a gig, it's so easy to be like, oh, this guy hates me. This is personal. I even had a booker at this festival this weekend. They had given me a ton of bookings 1 year, and then the bookings have fallen off a bit. And she said to me, she was like, don't think that this is a personal thing. She's like, this is just, you know, there's a million comics and a lot of people are bringing their own features. So it's gigs are, you know, there's less and less of them. But yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to be persistent, like at least a monthly email to these bookers.
Monthly email.
With a veils, just saying, hey, these are the dates I'm open. Not begging for spots, because I don't want to be the guy I don't want to be the guy that the club is finally like, all right, this guy's hassled us. Let's just get him a spot.
Right.
Because even if I get in, it goes well, I'm still in their mind, I'm like the hassling guy. And I don't want to be that. Some people call it hustling. Some people call it hassling. I think it can be a little bit of both, you know?
Yeah.
But it's also like important to be patient, because it's like I've emailed bookers for a year and not gotten any response. And then suddenly they're like, hey, are you available this weekend? And I'm like, yeah. And then sometimes you are, sometimes you aren't. But if you are, it's like, boom, now you're in. And you've waited it out. It's such a comedy, such a long game that it's like the moment you think that you're above an old booker and you want to be like, I don't need their gigs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly you're like, I wish I had those gigs. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because it's like, you know, you get a great, 1 week you'll get great gigs, high pay, ton of shows, sell a bunch of merch. The next week you're at a gig that doesn't pay as well. You don't sell a ton of merch. But it's like, even doing that gig, it still filled out your calendar. So you're making a little money and you're getting better at comedy.
Are you organized and tracking shows and how they went and how organized are you on the back end? Because you're a business. Organization could be a big part of running that business efficiently.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty organized, but I also have a pretty good memory of what that show was like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can, you know, you always remember the bad ones more than the good ones, I think. But I think that helps to know this is how I did there. Like normally if I go to a club and do a guest spot, because I'll do that sometimes, I'll say, hey, you know, I'd like you to see me. Can I just come do a guest spot? And I'll do it for free, you know, no hotel. It'll cost me money. But almost every time, I would say 95% of the time I've done that, I've gotten a booking out of it. But I did, I went to Milwaukee one time to this place, and it was a Thursday night, and they had four people in the club. And I did 5 minutes and never made them laugh. And I still talked to the owner after. I was like, hey, I don't know why you would book me based off that set, but I would like to come back. And I didn't.
I was waiting for it.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, I get it. Like, if I'm booking, I mean, I book a show at Zany's, and it's like, if I'm booking a show and the guy asking for the spot just bombed, I'm like, I don't know what my incentive is to book you, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it is a business. Like, and I get that comedy clubs want to make money. And they, I mean, you know, it's like a restaurant. If you go to a restaurant and you eat this meal and the meal's terrible, you're like, I'm probably not coming back to this place. I feel like it's the same for a comedy club. If you come in, you see a show and it's terrible, you're like, I may not go back to that.
Mm-hmm.
You might give it another shot, but maybe not. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm like, I try to look at it from that standpoint. It's like, let's give them something good all the time. Like, I know a club, and from what I understand, they won't do an open mic because they don't want people to see bad comedy at the club. And an open mic, you know, is they can be great, but they can be terrible.
It can leave a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And ruin comedy for you.
Right. Right.
Yes.
Right. And especially if you're in a city not known for comedy. Like, if you go to New York City and you see an open mic and it's terrible, you're probably just going to say that's a terrible open mic.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to Nashville and see a bad open mic, you're going to go, comedy's bad in Nashville, because it's not known for that.
Right.
You can see bad music in Nashville and go, that was just a bad show,
mm-hmm.
because it's known for music. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. I just think that it's, you want to, I think in that Steve Martin book, I read part of it. I usually read about half of a book and then I feel like I got it. And,
Born Standing Up, is that
yeah.
book? Okay.
Yeah. He says something like, you want to be good all the time so you can be great sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important. And that's sometimes the challenge for trying out new jokes. Like, if I'm in a club, sometimes I'm in a club and I feel like I'm barely surviving. Like, they're laughing, but one bad joke could send them to their phones.
Right, right.
You know?
It's barely on.
Yeah.
Every joke, you're like, oh, one more.
Yeah,
one
more. Yeah. Yeah.
Familiar feeling.
But then sometimes the show's going so well that I'm like, I don't want to tank this with a new joke. Like, mm-hmm. But so it's like that challenge of balancing. And then open mics too, it's like, I can go do a joke at an open mic and it could crush. And I'm like, good, new joke. And then I take it to a regular club in front of regular people, and they're not having it. Because it could be some weird reference. I could make a He-Man reference at an open mic, and everyone's going to laugh. But in the general world, they might not even remember that guy.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you've seen what He-Man actually looks like on the cartoon recently, but it's pretty funny.
I have not.
Yeah, you should check that. He has like a little blonde bob haircut with some bangs.
Uh-huh.
And it's like, this is He-Man? This was the strong guy that we liked?
Oh, and he was in like tights, I'm guessing?
Oh, yeah.
Sort of brief?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and He-Man was great. I loved that show as a kid, but watching the intro, you can just type in He-Man intro on YouTube. It's pretty funny.
All right, you all have homework out there.
Yeah.
Go watch the He-Man intro.
And if you just want a funny video, you should watch this video called, it's about Karate Kid, how Daniel was the real bully.
Huh.
It's so funny.
Interesting.
It's nothing to do with me, but I watched it the other day and I laughed.
Start plugging other people's
yeah, sorry,
projects.
Yeah.
My buddy has a cool YouTube channel.
Yeah, it's funny though. It's worth a watch.
You've been getting on YouTube, or you've been trying to build a channel and that.
Yeah,
jazz.
I mean, I'm just trying to do something that I like doing that I also think is fun. I mean, I like country music, so I have this thing where I do top five country songs,
mm-hmm.
and I just try to do different topics. But mainly, it's just me. Like, I love to recommend songs to people because I think that country music is great. But I think that if you go into the wrong country, you could be like, oh, I hate this. So I'm trying to show great country, and I like 70s, 80s, 90s country.
Mm.
So I'm trying to show that off, and it does fine. I think the videos are great. If you like country music, you'll love them.
Do a little Conway Twitty in there? You throw a little him in
yeah,
there?
I got a little Conway Twitty. I love him, but I just got to find some more categories to fit him in.
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I think I want to put him in kind of a, He has a song called Lay You Down. I'd Love to Lay You Down. Mm-hmm. And I think that first verse is really pretty. It's pretty sexual. Conway Twitty's pretty sexual.
Hello, darling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And and I don't think that people see him that way, but he's pretty sexual. And that I'd Love to Lay You Down. Once he gets into the second, third verse, you realize that he's talking about his wife and it's a sweet song. But the first one doesn't feel sweet at all.
It's like an R. Kelly. He's out there.
He's basically saying in this song, he's like, I'm not gonna mess around with you right here. I'm just letting you know I'd like to have sex with you. That's basically what that first verse says. I could tell you a lot of things, but what I'm saying is I'd like to have sex with you.
Not a good icebreaker for bookers. Yeah. You don't want to open up with that.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks for doing this, man.
Yeah.
Seriously, I've been a fan of you for a while now. To see you on Kimmel was awesome. And now to get to sit down with you and even just see how that all happened is great.
Yeah, and with this video, people can see how awkward that I am in when I'm sitting down. I think I don't sit on stairs a lot. So I move my hands and I'm always like this. That's why the wave helps me with comedy, because I get to do something with my hand. Because I'm always like this. I'm doing, and then I touch my glasses, then I touch my hat, and then I touch my pants. I don't know what it is. I'm like a third base coach. You know what I mean?
This is my first interview sitting crisscross applesauce.
Yeah.
So this is like a first for both of us sitting here on the stairs.
Yeah, this is my Airbnb here.
Out here in ATL?
College Park.
We out here.
Yeah, I feel like Ludacris had some College Park references.
Totally. That's why I was worried about coming down here with all this equipment. I was like, am I going to be safe? This house is clearly gentrification at its finest.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Yeah, very nice people here.
So in closing, is there anything else you want the world to know?
Well, I have a podcast that I've started called We're Having a Good Time Podcast with my wife, Hannah Hogan, and she's also a comic, and it's a fun time. And then, you know, all my social media is at Dusty Slay. That's DustySLay. And I mean, it's fun. I try to use all my social medias, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, for different things. Like if I share a picture on Instagram, I try not to share it on Facebook and Twitter. I try to have them be separate entertainment things. So if you follow all them, you'll get different stuff.
Interesting. What's the strategy behind that?
Well, I just don't want, like, I feel like sometimes if an Instagram post gets a ton of likes, I'll share it on Facebook. But I'm just trying to make those be different things, you know, like, so you get a little something different. Like if I have something that's a little edgier or I don't think is as funny, I'll put it on Twitter because, you know, my aunt doesn't follow me on Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? But at Facebook, I got a lot of relatives. So if it's edgy, I don't want to put it on Facebook, you know, because I got, and then Instagram, I feel like is just a fun picture thing.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Is Facebook more, do you use that more for the promo side of things?
Yeah, that's definitely where I'm like, I'm doing a show, but I do promo on all of them for sure. And I try not to be annoying about it. I try to keep my promo funny too, but I got to let people know when shows are happening because I always post a picture and I feel like, oh, I'm being really annoying about my promotion. And then when the weekend's over, someone will go, oh, I didn't know you were in St. Louis. And it's like, well, I posted it 5 times.
Right.
I don't know how you missed it. It's like they wait. It's their way of saying, sorry, we missed you.
Yeah.
We couldn't make it. We were doing stuff.
Even though they saw all 5.
Yeah. People will email me. People will message me and they'll be like, oh, when you coming to town? When you coming to town? I'm like, next week, I'll be there. And they're like, oh, we're busy Thursday. I'm like, I'm there Friday too. They're like, busy then. Well, 3 shows Saturday. Oh, can't do it. Can't find a babysitter. You know, just can't do
it. Saving up money to go see Carlos Mencia.
Right, right.
We don't have time.
Yeah, I had this guy that used to work in the bank that I used to go to all the time. And I would always tell him about comedy. I was always inviting him to my shows. $10 my shows were. And he never would come. And then one day I went in there and he goes, I finally saw a comedy show. And I was like, oh, great. Who'd you see? And he was like, Aziz Ansari. Cost him like $70. Yeah. I was like, all right, well, appreciate you coming to my $10 show. You know, you work in the bank. Get some money out of here.
People don't have that perspective. Inside the comedy world, we're like, oh, this is very important. And everybody knows everything about comedy. Yeah. This guy was on Late Night. It was so cool. And then most people are like, who? You're like, no, they had their own TV show. No, I don't remember. Wait, did he? I don't know.
Yeah.
They just unless it's like the 1% of comedy, people have no idea most of the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my dad told me I should be more like Jeff Dunham and get some puppets. You know what I mean?
Hilarious.
Get you some puppets. My dad came to a show that I bombed at in Columbus, Georgia.
Perfect. And I've bombed in Columbus. I've been there. Yeah. In front of my dad, actually.
That's awesome. Yeah. Because Columbus, I'm from Alabama, so Columbus is pretty close to where I'm from. Uh-huh. So I was doing a show. My dad came. My dad came with his wife, his cousin, and his wife, and then my cousin's friends from church, and then his nephew and his wife. And I bombed so bad.
Uh-huh.
And then the next week, my dad was in Gatlinburg, and he went to the Comedy Barn and posted about how great the show was. You know what I mean? And I wrote on there, oh, finally seeing some real comedy.
Right.
And it got no likes. I got no love for that. I don't think they got my sarcasm.
Well, I get it. That's why I'm a fan of you, man. Yeah, just the first time I saw you, I was like, this guy is a great comedian, and he's also an authentic comedian. So kudos, man.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem.
Thank you. Yeah, I don't think it's fun to be, I don't know, it's more fun to be authentic, you know? Mm-hmm. That's why I like to make fun of myself, because I'm not beating myself up. But we all should be able to laugh at ourselves, you know? I mean, my life is fine. But I like to make fun of myself. I find myself in some interesting situations, you know?
I think it's crucial for longevity, too. You can only fake it for so long.
Yeah, totally. Totally. And that's why it's hard for me to want to leave the South, because to live. I love to go to New York. I love going to LA. I love to go to the Midwest. It's mm-hmm. so fun to visit these places. But I feel like if I move out of my environment, then it's going to change me, because I will adapt to wherever I'm living, you know? But maybe it'd be all right. Maybe I'd look good with a New York accent, you know?
Are you thinking about moving? Is that like
I don't know. It's step? It's always something I'm thinking about.
Right.
But I don't know. I go there, I like it, and then I'm happy to leave. You know what I mean?
You just go there, you can go there, do the work, and then come back home.
I love it. I love strolling around New York. I like to put my headphones in, listen to some country music while I'm rolling around in the subway. Mm-hmm. It's great. But I don't know. I mean, living there, it's expensive too, and it's like, I do comedy full-time right now. I don't know that I could do comedy full-time and pay, $2,000 a month in rent.
I'm at the point now where I'm like, I'll move if it's for work. I'm not going to move to just keep doing shows. Like, I'll move if there's like a job
right
on the other end of that move.
Yeah.
I'm not just going to move for the sake of saying I did.
Yeah. And I was thinking about, like, today I was like, I'm not that crazy about getting back into the struggle. Like, I found a comfortable life, right?
Right,
I'm not.
Right.
But then I saw, weirdly, this Frederick Douglass quote that said, where there is no struggle, there is no progress. And I thought, is he talking to me right now?
Ooh.
Yeah.
But you can create struggle within your own, like, with where you are and trying out new things and new, like, the podcast in itself. People don't understand how much work a podcast is. The amount of time that goes into a podcast. Like you said, the first one you guys recorded 3 times.
Yeah.
And you thought you were just going to sit down and just BS for
a
while.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work, and that's a struggle. So you can find struggles without being dramatic about it.
And well, that's true. That is true. I thought it was a whole political post about Frederick Douglass's life, about being a slave to where he got to at the end of life. And I'm like, does he mean comedy?
The ultimate comedian mindset.
Right.
Everything wraps back around to comedy, right?
right.
Oh, that's perfect. Oh, Dusty Slay, thanks for being on Hot Breath, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
Had a great time.
We're having a good time.
Appreciate
you, man.
Yeah, thank you.
Let's put her there.
Yeah, this is great.
Awesome. You had fun?
I loved it.
Good.
I loved it.
I kept moving my legs around. I kept falling asleep.
That's what I was doing. I kept doing like this, and I'm just like, and then I'm crossing my arms, and then I'm leaning back, and I'm just like, I look pretty uncomfortable.
Yeah,
I think, but
both legs kept falling asleep.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Yeehaw! Thank you, Dusty, and thank you, Hot Brethren and Sistren, for tuning in. If you haven't seen his Jimmy Kimmel appearance yet, I will play a fun audio clip of it at the end, but you gotta see the full thing on YouTube as well. He is an absolutely incredible comedian. You really just, his voice is one dimension, but you gotta see him to believe him. So definitely go check him out. Check out last week's as well. Mia Jackson was on here talking about working with Amy Schumer and Arsenio Hall. I do have a quick correction on that one. I told her she was the second repeat guest on here, but she's actually the third. She's our three-peat. We had Rob Hayes, who has since been on Jimmy Fallon and started his own podcast, Book of Yay, and he's been on Viceland and just awesome dude. He was our number one Hot Breath episode and our 100th Hot Breath episode, our live Hot Breath episode, number 100.
Clayton English. I interviewed him before he won Last Comic Standing and then after to see how his career changed. And then, of course, now Mia Jackson, who episode 129, you can hear right before this one. Just subscribe. Catch up. This has really become a complete passion project for not only me learning about comedy, but I hope you learn about comedy as well. Whether you are an open micer or a headlining comedian on the road listening to something productive as opposed to just other comics rambling about their grocery lists. Or if you're a comedy fan that really enjoys the ins and outs, however you found this, I certainly appreciate it. All I'd say, return the favor. However you heard about it, you know, spread the word. Word of mouth is always a powerful way to bring awareness into the hot breath-averse. So share it on Facebook, tag someone on social media, tell a coworker, tell a friend that wants to be a comedian but is a little questioning it. I want this podcast to be really a how-to guide on how you can build your own comedy career. So thank you for being a part of it, especially in these early stages. It's 130 hot breath episodes, but that still pales in comparison to the impact we want to make here. And with your help, we can do that even sooner. If you do want to support me, you know, see me out there doing the jokes. I'm bobbing my head right now, if you can't tell. But if you want to hear me doing the jokes, I host a show every Wednesday at Java Monkey in Decatur, Georgia. I also have my schedule on my website, joelbyerscomedy.com. On there, there's links to my comedy class I teach. The next round starts in June. If you'd like to join up, it's an 8-week course. You can go on there, sign up, or at highwirecomedy.com. My book also is available on my website. You know, there's links to all the episodes from the podcast, my schedule. But in all honesty, I just want to connect with you. So if you have any questions about the podcast, about comedy, about writing, about public speaking, I mean, whatever, if you want to connect with me, you can connect with me on my website or joelbyerscomedy@gmail.com or social media at Joel Byers Comedy. I want to help, you know, so however I can, reach out, I'm happy to. And thanks for helping me keep the hot breath-averse alive by listening all the way through this outro. So we will get out of here now, but I genuinely do appreciate your attention and support. So, of course, I have to thank my engineer, Amon Garner, the A1 Day One. He's actually, I see him out there working on other podcasts now as well. So shout out to Amon. If you want help with your podcast or any other audio needs, hit him up on Facebook, Amon Garner, A-M-O-N Garner. Dope dude, dope engineer. And of course, last but not least, my wife, Erin Byers. I'm forever indebted to her for making the theme song of this podcast. So now for 130 hot breath episodes, I have thanked her from saying thank you to my girlfriend to now thank you to my wife. And we have since started our own podcast called Byers Life. If you want to check that out on iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and all that jazz, it's just called Byers Life. You can just Google it or do whatever you got to do on the internet to find it. But it shows another side of me and my wife and my dog and, yeah, being a grown-up. But anyway, this is fun time. So let's get out of here. Get on with your days, hot brethren and sisterin. I genuinely appreciate you. And until next Monday, right here on Hot Breath. Hot breath.
Our next guest is a very funny man with a great comedian name. You can see him headline the Charleston Comedy Festival in South Carolina on January 19th, making his television debut. Please welcome Dusty Slay.
All right. All right. All right. I grew up in a trailer park, which wasn't that fun. So not sure why they call it a park. You know what I mean? There wasn't no rides in there. There's a lot of money out there, a lot of different kinds of money. There's like old money, new money, blood money, drug money. We didn't have any of that. What we had was good money, right? That's why your parents buy you something you don't like. They go, we paid good money for that. Good money buys the worst stuff, too. It's never anything good.
Good money buys like airbrush t-shirts with your name on it from the county fair. I had a lot of t-shirts with wolves on it growing up. My mom thought I'd look good in a wolf t-shirt. She was like, the more wolves, the better. Put them all over that thing. Maybe put a little moon on there. Give that wolf something to howl at. I had a hat growing up, just had my name airbrushed across the top. Just said Dusty right across it. That's just so I wouldn't get kidnapped. Kidnapper sees that hat. He's like, nah, his family ain't got no money. Just give him the candy. Right? Just let him have the candy. He probably ain't had candy in a long time. I'm out there trying to get in the van. They're like, no, no. We are kidnappers. I'm like, I know, I'm a kid. Trying to get napped up in here. I live in Nashville, Tennessee now. And all right, thank you, thank you. And last December, we had a tornado warning. And I was listening to the radio, and they were telling us what to do during this tornado warning based on what kind of house you live in, right? It said, if you live in a house with a basement, go into the basement. If you live in a house without a basement, go into a bathroom or a small room. And they were like, if you live in a trailer park, we want you to go to a neighbor's house or go outside and lay down in the ditch. That's the real news. They're like, listen, we don't know what to tell you. Hell, you made some bad decisions along the way. Now you got to deal with this. I'm like, we can't help you. They're like, yeah, I know it's raining out there and that ditch is going to be full of water. Just get down in it. Yeah, it's December. It's going to be cold. You're probably going to get sick. Just get down in there. I like that they think that there's a ditch located next to every trailer park, right? Like it just comes with it. Every trailer park gets their own tornado ditch. No trash in this ditch unless it's white trash, you know? Right. We're having a good time. We're having a good time. I like that the other option they give you is to go to a neighbor's house, right? Because I don't know what kind of trailer parks they know about. But the trailer park that I grew up in, my neighbor also lived in a trailer. It's like they just want us to meet up in one, maybe weight it down. That way the tornado can't carry it on. We weren't real poor, though. We just didn't have everything, you know? Like, I never got ice cream growing up. My mom used to just pour milk into a bowl. Then she'd call me into the room and go, well, you're too late.
Hot Breath.
This episode of Hot Breath is sponsored by our Patreon. If any of our content has helped your comedy career, join our Patreon linked in the show notes and get positive comedy karma for life. Probably.